This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear from the Illinois State University professor who's pushing for a required course on cultural diversity.
Research that looks at what employers are looking for, understanding diversity or intercultural competence, is one of the top 10.
GLT's Ryan Denham talks with Rocio Rivadeneira, who's heading a committee proposing the new requirement. Loyola's number one fan and top team expert calls Bloomington Normal home. GLT's Ryan Denham talks with John Thomas about the Ramblers' amazing season. And Laura Kennedy previews the latest play from Heartland Theater, The Ghost of Floyd Collins. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's April 3rd, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Normal Council has an unexpected savings on insurance costs. There's also an update on Uptown redevelopment, and the mayor takes a leave of absence. GLT's Charlie Schlenker has more with the Town of Normal mayor.
The mayors of Normal and Bloomington stopped by Sound Ideas following their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Chris Coos, thanks for your time.
Good afternoon.
New city manager Pam Reese wore several hats in her old position of deputy city manager. That included human resources director. You are laying off some people in administration as part of budget cuts. Reese's old job is vacant. How is the reshuffle shaping up?
Well, the first thing that's happened in the reshuffle is Terry Legner, our IT director, who's had previous administration experience in other communities, is stepping in as interim deputy city manager until such time as Pam decides on a permanent hire.
Is that a deputy city manager or is that an assistant city
manager?
Well,
probably an assistant city manager.
So what happens to human resources, that function?
Part of Pam's role as being the human relations director was to groom a current staff member to take over that position, and she is doing that.
So that person is going to get it on a permanent basis or,
yes.
or
yes.
a test drive?
Permanent basis.
Okay. Should the town then continue with a deputy or revert to assistant with a more limited portfolio?
You know, that's really Pam's decision to make. We have talked about it. I'm concerned about her work-life balance, and I've communicated that to her. But she'll be the one to ultimately make that decision.
How many ways are there to slice that loaf of bread? What's common in municipalities in the upper tier of administration? How do they divvy things up?
There's no set rule for it. Pam's job was working with HR. She worked with fire. She did the union negotiations. So she and Mark kind of split up the departments and in terms of overview. So she's had a lot of experience overseeing departments already.
Okay. Well, that weight of duties allowed her to make the case and to prove herself and to train herself up to be city manager. And with your expression of a concern over life-work balance, is that I guess that's not sustainable in the long run.
We'll see. You know, she's very aware of it, too. It's not like she's ignoring the issue at all. One of the vacancies that'll come up won't happen until December. So she won't be downstaffed that much.
Is that the assistant city
yes.
manager? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the time frame to fill that on a permanent basis.
Right.
Is that a highly sought after stepping stone for a lot of municipalities? Is that going to create a good talent pool?
It generally is, although, you know, talking to people in the city manager business, younger people are not going into government service that much. So there's kind of a talent drain out there right now because people aren't going into municipal government.
What will the town have to do to make that an attractive position to attract a piece of talent that is worthy of the job and worthy of the town?
You know, I think the culture of the community, the culture of the town staff and the council gives us a leg up on a lot of municipalities. It's a place people want to work because they recognize it as a quality environment.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Our guest today is Mayor Chris Koos of the town of Normal. Let's update the status of the Trail East project on the Circle in Uptown. When the council approved the multi-story mixed-use project earlier this year, it seemed possible construction could begin yet this year. Where stands it now?
I think construction will begin this year. It's really in design, preliminary design phase, and what the ownership group is finding is that there's a little more demand for office space than they originally anticipated. So they're working through that and talking to prospective tenants. And those tenants will have a lot to do on how that building gets designed.
There was some concern about the insistence of the potential developer on apartments. Is that serving to allay that if it's going to be more office space then?
Well, the last I talked to anybody about this, Charlie, there were going to be two floors of apartments there, and if another office tenant comes in, there may only be one floor.
Any public word yet on the potential technology company tenant?
I just know discussions are underway, and I've been told that that tenant sometimes can move glacially in terms of their decision making. They're very methodical and take their time.
Hooked into the design approval is also the finished development agreement, correct?
I'm not sure what you're referring
to. When the council takes up design approval, they'll also take up the final development agreement.
Yes.
In addition to the preliminary one that's already been put out there.
There'll be plenty of council input.
When do you think that is going to come?
I would think that we would see that maybe July at the earliest.
Insurance costs came in $315,000 under budget for the coming year. That is a 13% drop instead of a budget 8% increase. Why is that?
I think the experience, you know, in terms of number of claims that the city has had over the past couple of years, combined with our wellness programs and that, has helped to keep the costs under control. And it was a surprise, and we're a very happy surprise.
What's the historical trend?
Flat or slight increases.
When did the town start to do wellness programs, and are wellness programs providing empirical data of a benefit to the town?
Absolutely. We started the programs, the current program, probably 3 years ago, and employees are required to do a health checkup every year to get biometrics on their health, and that gives us information to be proactive with the employee for the employee to be proactive about their health.
And it's resulted in better claims experience?
It's resulted in better outcomes.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Chris Koos is the mayor of Normal. You announced last night you will take a leave of absence for most of this month for a treatment for prostate cancer. First of all, our best wishes for your recovery.
Thank you.
What is your prognosis?
It's looking pretty good. You know, it was caught early enough. We discussed a number of different treatments, and the treatment I'm going forward with is probably the best choice.
Are you a commercial for annual checkups or every 6 months checkups?
I am now, yes. You know, and it was we were having a discussion earlier about PSA and the current discussion about PSA tests showing false positives, but it was the trend of increase in my PSA that gave my doctor the warning that something might be afoul.
How will your absence affect policy discussion in the town?
I don't think it will affect it one bit. You know, the council is strong. I don't think there's a person on that council that couldn't step into that role. The people that are going to do it for the balance of this week, Kevin McCarthy, and then after that, Jeff Fritzen, are both seasoned and experienced policymakers, and they'll do fine.
What's the formal mechanism for a leave of absence?
Well, you know, I'm not sure. I may just have made it up. but I thought I was going to be gone for a period of time, and people deserved an explanation. The mayor pro tem, who's usually the senior council member, normally steps in a situation like that.
Is there a standard way municipalities construct these chains of command?
They don't, no. I mean, some municipalities will elect a mayor pro tem, but it's always been the policy of the town of Normal, and we could change that, but it's always been the policy of town of Normal that the senior member becomes mayor pro tem.
Is there any guide from municipal code, or can it just be town procedure and policy?
Well, I mean, we take formal action. I would say it's a policy, but once... Once there's a change and there's a need for a new mayor pro tem, it's a council action to elect that person.
What happens to the salary from your princely compensation package during your leave? And I say princely in all irony.
I've never asked that question.
Do you anticipate other issues coming before the council in that time?
In the next month?
Yeah.
No, not really. I think there is one or two issues that are upcoming, and we predetermined that they require a full council, not necessarily the mayor present, but a full council to make those decisions.
What are those issues?
Stay tuned.
Okay. Mayor Chris Koos of the Town of Normal, thanks so much. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Thank you.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us on Sound Ideas following regular and special council meetings. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, hear about a proposed course requirement on cultural diversity. GLT's Ryan Denham has more coming up during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. When the Loyola Ramblers men's basketball team went on an unexpected run to the Final Four in this year's NCAA basketball tournament, people across the country jumped on the bandwagon of the small Chicago-based university. Many had probably never heard of the school until this year. John Thomas of Bloomington is not one of those people. He became a diehard fan after stepping on campus as a student in 1994. He created a web message board for Rambler basketball fans and even started writing a book meant for the 40th anniversary of the 1963 title team. Thomas is in the studio for Sound Ideas to talk Loyola basketball with GLT's John Norton.
John Thomas, welcome to the studios.
Nice to be here.
Boy, it was a tough loss Saturday night, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was tough, you know, especially when you're ahead by 10 points in the second half and you start to get visions of going to the title game.
Well, you know, I'm an ISU basketball fan. You're a Loyola basketball uber fan, I would probably call it. Did you see this coming? Did anyone see this coming this year?
I don't think so. Preseason, Loyola was picked third for the Missouri Valley Conference. Last year, they were, you know, a pedestrian 18-14. They lost their best leading scorer, Milton Doyle. So a lot of people thought, I don't know. And then Porter Moser, the former ISU coach, hasn't had a winning conference season for a long time. I think going back to like 2003 was his last.
Right, in Arkansas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot of people had big doubts. And, you know, I thought we had really good talent.
What was the difference between this year's team that made this great run and last year's team?
Probably principally a big man in the center.
That Crutwig kid?
Crutwig.
Okay.
He's from Jacobs High School, and he's able to pass. He's a terrific passer. So the passing around for the best shot seemed to work a lot better this year when you had a big guy in the center who could distribute from in the paint.
Well, I mentioned you're an uber Loyola fan, and there weren't a whole lot of fans that, until this year, right? I mean, there haven't been a ton. But I want to get to you. You're a historian as well for Loyola. And you started writing a book about the 40th anniversary of Loyola's, 1963 championship?
That's right. Back in 2002, actually, I was looking for a way to distract from turning 40. So I decided to write a book about Loyola's 63 team. I think I can't recall if it was before or after Glory Road came out, which was about the UTEP 1966 championship, where you had five black players playing against five white players in the championship game. But Loyola had a racial impact by starting four African American players in 1963 when. The kind of gentleman's agreement that they had was you could play two black players on the road and three at home.
Well, how exciting is this run this year for the Loyola fans? I mean, well, go ahead.
Well, you know, having gone through a 33-year tournament drought.
Because it was 85 the
last time? 85 was the last time. And even since then, we haven't even had a whiff, really, of getting close. In 2002, we had an overtime game in the conference tournament final and almost got – it was a one-point overtime game, and that was the closest we've been. We haven't even gone to a conference tournament final except for that one time in the past 33 years.
Okay. Well, I mentioned that you are writing a book, and it never did get to completion, right? But it morphed into something else.
That's right. I run a fan site, RamblerMania.net. At that time, it was RamblerMania.com. And I couldn't find a publisher. I was going to some university presses looking for somebody to publish, and it was getting close to the 40th anniversary. So I decided to make it into a web series called 40 Years Ago Today. And it kind of tracked that whole 1963 season all the way through game by game. And one of the interesting things that I found out about it was on December 29th at a tournament in Oklahoma City, Loyola's white point guard fouled out of the game, and there were two guards on the bench who were white and one who was black, Pablo Robertson, who later became a Harlem Globetrotter. But they, Loyola's coach George Ireland, put in Pablo Robertson, and that is, according to my research and according to the research of the person who wrote an actual book that was published in 2013, that was the first known time that a major college team had five African-American players playing at the same time.
We're talking with John Thomas. He's an uber Loyola fan. He lives here in Bloomington, and you're also a historian and an author, and boy, you're an excited Loyola fan this year. You jumped on board, in 94? Is that right?
90, actually.
When you went to school at Loyola.
When I first started, yeah.
So there were, boy, you must have been one of the few, right? Because they were just a lot of dark years for Loyola basketball.
It was pretty bleak. I was just looking it up the other day, you know, just amazed at how far we've come since then. From 1992 to 1996, Loyola won only 28 games and lost 80.
Oh, my.
And five of those games were non-Division One. Five of those wins were non-Division One teams, so they were like, you know.
Were you hooked from the beginning, right when you stepped on campus?
Yeah, it was invigorating. I'd been in radio before, and I'd covered sports while in radio, and this was like sports, and it was also my college team, so I really latched onto it hard and quick.
What kept you a Loyola fan when it was really difficult to be a Loyola fan?
There were some great relationships that I had with some of the diehards, you know, and, you know, being diehards, you end up getting closer and, you know, developing friendships that, you know, when people move away, you still keep in contact with them. And you get together and you see them again at the game the following season. So that's really what's kept me, sticking close to Loyola all these years.
Well, we talked about the 1963 team just a little bit, and Jerry Harkness was on that team. He was the star of the team. Is that accurate? He was the star of the team?
Yeah, he was an All-American in 63.
And he was very prominent on the NCAA telecast this year. They were showing him in the stands, even doing some play-by-play and stuff like that. Did you get a chance to talk to Jerry about this run?
Yeah. No. I have spoken to him in the past. When I was working on the book, I interviewed Ron Miller, the old play-by-play guy, Red Rush, who made the legendary call that you may have seen when they showed the grainy photos of the 63 team winning the championship. Bill Joust, the legendary sportscaster, who was the Chicago Daily News.
I remember Bill. He was on that sports table, roundtable thing on TV.
The sports writers.
Yeah, he was a character.
Yeah. So I interviewed not just students who were on campus at the time to get their perspective on it. And, you know, it was a life-changing event for a lot of the people who were fans back then. And, you know, it's not quite the same thing, but the Final Four these days is a lot bigger than the championship was back then.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. I'm talking with John Thomas, who is a Loyola basketball fan, a historian, and author. He lives here in Bloomington. And did you grow up in Bloomington, Normal?
I did not. I had some distant relatives and inherited some property here, and so I relocated about 10 years ago.
Okay. So you would we had talked yesterday on the phone briefly, and you talked about the what was called the wall of culture that Loyola has.
Yeah, that's
like a philosophy or something. Or
when Porter Moser came in at Loyola, he had to do a total rebuild. I mean, break the whole program down to bare earth. And one of the things he wanted to do was to instill a culture of winning. And so he began by marking up on the wall of the locker room some of the sayings that he learned from Rick Majerus in the time between he was at ISU and at Loyola.
And Majerus coached down at St. Louis University.
That's right.
Okay, yeah.
And he's considered one of the best basketball minds. And these little phrases are like keys that mean much larger things, philosophies about basketball, how to guard your man, how to stand without getting fouled. And so all of these phrases are on this wall of culture that's kind of helped build a winning attitude.
So that's one of the things I noticed and was brought up in the tournament is Loyola doesn't foul. The kids don't foul out, or they have this penchant for blocking shots and not being able to foul
people. I believe it's the only team in college basketball this year that did not have a single player to foul out.
That's an amazing statistic.
Yeah, and, you know, it gives them an edge because you limit the number of points that are scored from the other opponent's foul shooting. You can play your best players all the way through the game and don't have to worry about foul trouble as much.
Well, what happened this year? Is it sustainable? What's going on next year and the years following?
Loyola loses 2 4-year starting players who have were part of the first recruiting class after Loyola joined the MVC in 2013. And they've helped to change the culture and elevate the program. Also losing Andre Jackson, who's a major contributor. However, there are some pretty big players. There's a transfer from New Mexico, 6'7" transfer, Ahur Ugak, who's coming in. And
well, if we keep Sister Jean around too, that'll be
helpful.
She
will definitely be there.
Why, that was a neat story in itself.
Yeah, and you know, this is the first time Loyola's been in the tournament in the age of social media, and it just exploded.
Well, it should be fun next year. ISU looks like it's going to be tough. Loyola's going to return a good team.
ISU is going to be a big challenge. Very athletic team, and now they've got another year of experience. It's going to have a lot of senior leadership, so they're one to watch out for.
John Thomas, great to talk to you and get to know you a little bit. And love talking basketball. Come back sometime.
I will if you invite me.
Okay, I'm John Norton.
GLT's John Norton talking with Ramblers historian and Bloomington Normal resident John Thomas. I'm Mike McCurdy, and this is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. We'll be right back. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. College is an eye-opening experience, and for freshmen coming from majority white communities, it may be their first real exposure to diverse cultures. Illinois State University wants to go one step further. It's considering a plan to require all undergraduates to take a course focused on inclusion, diversity, equity, and access in American society. GLT's Ryan Denham spoke with Rocio Rita-Venera, a faculty member and chair of the committee that proposed the requirement. She says it's not just the university that wants more culturally competent graduates, it's their future employers.
We know that the country is changing, right? The demographic is changing, so we're becoming a more diverse population. And I think for a while, a lot of faculty, staff, and even students that I talk to have been interested in issues of diversity, issues of inclusion and equity, and learning, seeing that more infused in the curriculum. So the idea for this committee actually came from the campus climate survey that was done at this point 2 years ago, I believe. And that task force, actually one of the kind of recommendations that they had was to diversify the curriculum and included having a graduation requirement that focused on U.S. diversity. So we already have AMALI, which is a graduation requirement that requires our students to take a course on kind of a non-Western society. And the idea or impetus behind that is that we are becoming an increasingly global world. We're interconnected, and we want to prepare our students for that, for working with people from various countries. And so we've had that requirement for a while, but I think myself, others, the committee had wondered, why don't we have something? We have diversity here in the United States, right? It's not just outside of our borders. It exists here in the United States. And as our students from all walks of life are going to have career paths that lead them to working with people and collaborating with people from different walks of life, we're doing them a disservice by not preparing them for that.
Let's dig into a few of the key points that you mentioned here. So I guess, first of all, why is this necessary? What are some of the things that you and others on this university committee think that students are maybe not being exposed to or learning right now as it exists before they graduate?
Well, the interesting thing is I think a lot of our students are getting some of that in the curriculum already. But, you know, some of them, depending on their major, depending on how they navigate the gen ed requirements, might be missing these perspectives, right? So they might be taking European history, which, again, could be very diverse, but it might not be. And so we're saying, hey, we want you to take at least one course that's going to look at a perspective different than yours, or maybe that's not kind of the same kind of standard mainstream experience, and get to know, you know, maybe the Latino population, Asian Americans, African American history, music. It could really be coming from different disciplines. And I think that's the great thing about our proposal is that we're not really necessarily adding a class. And I think for most students, it won't be adding a class. It's maybe guiding them to a class that they may not have considered in the past. And really, that's part of the great thing about our proposal is that it's already taking courses that are out there, both in general education and major specifics, and saying, hey, we want you to at least have one of these courses. And the idea is that maybe once they explore some of these topics from these different perspectives, it might encourage them to explore these different populations more. And for students who might identify with some of these minority populations, it might empower them to feel like, hey, I'm important enough to be part of this curriculum. You know, my perspectives, my family's perspectives, my people's perspectives is important enough to be considered valuable and worthy of study. And so I think it serves kind of all of our population, right? Students who might not have had exposure to these histories, these cultural backgrounds, these challenges, these obstacles, these wonderful experiences, but also for students who are coming from these groups to say, hey, this is valuable and worthy of academic study.
So what kinds of courses could ultimately be on this menu of inclusion, diversity, equity, and access in U.S. society? Even in broad strokes, can you give some examples of what these actually might be?
Sure. So we already have a course called U.S. Diversity. It's, you know, a lot of our freshmen take that. That's one. I have taught a course in psychology, some faculty in psychology, called Latino Psychology, right? And that's another example. So we're looking at psychological theory and data and research, but focusing on Latino population. For example, Latino adolescents, you know, most of what they're doing in terms of adolescence, it's going to look similar to what we've seen in adolescent development, which is another course I teach. But there's some things that might be specific to that population, maybe ethnic identity development, right? So that's something that we might explore a little more deeply. You know, what does that look like for a minority youth who's in a, you know, in a majority culture? What's the added experience of not only developing their general identity, but in particular their ethnic identity, for example? Other courses that we might have, history, African-American history, different types of music. I was going to say African music, but that's actually more of a Mali course. But so again, the focus is on diversity within the U.S., acknowledging that the U.S. hasn't always been this monolithic one, you know, majority culture experience, but that there's always been, you know, Latino voices, African-American voices, gay voices, female voices, and really kind of putting those just side by side with the other experiences as well.
These are not necessarily new courses being created. These already exist. You're just kind of changing the way that students might discover them or be introduced to them.
Yeah. So we, you know, it's a way of putting them out there a little more in front of students, and guiding them towards that and saying, hey, this is important enough that we think this is you should take a course.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Rocio Rivadeneira, director of the Honors Program at Illinois State University and the chair of a committee that has proposed a new diversity course requirement for ISU students. Rocio, what effect do you think this course would have on a student's future, their ability to operate in the world, their ability to interact with others in a future workplace?
I think it really does give them a competitive advantage to say, hey, I've taken maybe not one course, but again, if it leads them to discovering a minor, for example, they might decide, oh, maybe I do want to do a minor in women and gender studies or Latin American and Latino studies or African American studies, that's going to set you apart from somebody who hasn't taken those classes or experiences. And in fact, if I could allude to the honors program a little bit, we just recently added that as one of our skill sets that we are emphasizing with our students. We've added intercultural competence as a skill set. We have six skill sets now that we want our students to get in the honors program. And that's one that also we said, hey, this is important. Students wanted it. If you look at research that looks at what employers are looking for, understanding diversity or intercultural competence, working with people who are different from you, is one of the top 10 skill sets that they're looking for. Those soft skill sets that they're looking for, like critical thinking, creative productivity, thinking outside the box. They also want people who can work, get along with people and collaborate with people from different backgrounds than they are.
ISU has a very high graduation rate relative to peer institutions, but it's not easy for every student to graduate on time. Are there concerns that adding this course requirement is another hurdle that students will have to jump over, or are you kind of accommodating for that?
I think part of what our committee looked at was what are the courses that already exist that would capture that would be tagged with this you know, it fits the ideas requirement. And we basically saw we already have a lot of those classes. So again, it's more guiding students to that. And for most, probably all students, it will be something that will already count towards their major, count towards a general education requirement. So it won't add really any more coursework for them. It'll be something that they can easily fit into their already fit schedule, because it's going to be a class that gets counted in multiple ways, if that makes sense.
Academia has at times faced criticism from conservatives on all sorts of fronts, but the core claim being that college campuses are sort of like a liberal bastion, where you've got liberal professors espousing liberal political beliefs to impressionable young people. That's a criticism that this diversity course requirement might face, potentially. I guess, what's your response to that?
I would say that diversity is not not a liberal or conservative issue. It's a human issue. It's, you know, interacting with people, interacting with your neighbors, interacting with your coworkers, interacting with clients, with patients, with your students. I think that's just the future of the United States. It's the past of the United States. It's the history of the United States, but it's also the future as we're becoming, again, a much more diverse demographic, a more diverse population. We can't hide our heads in the sand and pretend that, you know, we're not becoming this, because we are. And so, again, we're giving students a disservice by not preparing them for that. So I would argue it's not a conservative or liberal issue. It's just a human issue. It's just preparing our students for becoming, you know, the future employees of this world.
Yeah. Your committee will seek input from the campus community with some open forums that are coming up this week. Tell me about those and what kind of feedback you're looking for.
Sure. So the Academic Senate and the University Curriculum Committee are sponsoring a couple of forums, Tuesday and Wednesday. So this is April 3rd, April 4th, 3 to 4 p.m. at Stevenson 401. And we invite all of the campus community students, faculty, staff to come in and give us their feedback. We're going to present our learning objectives, a little bit more of the history of how we got here, some sample courses that we think are going to fit that, and really just it's a time to get feedback from the community. So we'll have a little bit of presentation, but we want to hear from the university, from the campus about, you know, is there something we've missed here? You know, what are your thoughts on this proposal?
That's Rocio Rivadeneira, director of the Honors Program at Illinois State University, and the chair of a committee that has proposed a new diversity course requirement for ISU students. I'm Ryan Denham.
The campus community is invited to share their feedback on the proposed diversity class during open forums from 3 to 4 p.m. today and Wednesday in Stevenson Hall, room 401. It's Sound Ideas.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we get to the bottom of life's big questions. As perhaps the nation's best known astrophysicist or scientist of any kind, do you agree that planetarium shows are much better when you're high?
Maybe that's not the right question. Maybe the question is everything better when you're high?
All right. Wasting Neil deGrasse Tyson's precious time and yours, it's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR. Listen Saturday at 9 a.m. on GLT, News and Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Mike Thornton Agency, presenting the musical and political comedy satire of the Capitol Steps with Orange is the New Barack at the BCPA Sunday, May 13th. The Capitol Steps have been putting the mock in democracy for 36 years. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. In 1925, a young man ventured down into a dark Kentucky cave and did not come out alive. His name was Floyd Collins, and his story inspired a musical that steeped in Americana. It's the latest production from Heartland Theater, and Laura Kennedy has more.
It's early evening, midweek, and mid-rehearsal process at Heartland Theater in Normal, and the cast of Floyd Collins is warming up. They're staging the musical that was ripped from the headlines 90 years ago. Floyd Collins tells the tragic tale of a young cave explorer who became trapped in Sand Cave, part of Mammoth Cave in Kentucky. The rescue operation resulted in a media circus above ground, while Floyd Collins remained trapped below. Despite efforts by rescuers, Collins died and passed into legend. Later that year, his tale was turned into a song, The Death of Floyd Collins.
Oh, come on, you young people, and listen while I tell the fate of Floyd Collins, the man we all knew well. His face was fair and handsome, his heart was true.
The sad tale of the young cave explorer inspired others as well. Adam Gettle and Tina Landau created the musical Floyd Collins, a show that drew high praise from no less than Stephen Sondheim. The show is opening this weekend at Heartland Theater. The director is Sandra Zielinski, who says the first time she saw this show, the story and music impacted her deeply.
I love the story. It is a simple story, but it is about storytelling and telling about this man who was underground and what he went through during this time and all of the chaos above the ground with people coming from miles and miles and miles away. Even Lindbergh, flying his plane, shot a photo of the area because there were hundreds of cars coming in. So you have that versus the one man who is underground.
You know, it strikes me as very poignant because what we have here is how one man's pain becomes the obsession of the moment.
Yes, absolutely. And it was one of the top three stories in the United States that year. So it was an obsession. However, you have hawkers, you have people there because it's the thing to do, and literally, they dance on his grave.
Actor John Kazarowski is the title character. He sings in the Sound of Illinois chorus. Heartland artistic director Rhys Lovell was scouting for tenors in the chorus to cast as reporters in the show. Kazarowski got the job. And then, in true showbiz fashion, he got something more.
The Floyd, who was originally cast, had to drop out of the production, and through a series of, I think, text messages and frantic phone calls and emails, eventually it was decided that I would be Floyd. And that was about 9 days ago. And so
how are things going?
It's a bit of a sprint. In certain cases, deceptively difficult music. In other cases, it's fully obvious how difficult it is. It's been quite a lot, and to try to catch up from a character standpoint to rehearsals that have been going on and conversations that have been going on for the last several weeks, actually, it's been an interesting process, but everybody's been awesome about agreeing to come in at different times and catch me up to speed and being very, very understanding of certain interesting notes and rhythms coming from my face.
Time inside has a way of flowing on,
going on a wide.
It'd take itself a dive.
Time inside kind of puts me in a mind of when Mama was alive. When Mama was alive, no one even says a word.
The vocal director of the show is Joe Penrod. He says the personality of the music is uniquely American and unlike anything composer Adam Gettle has done before. Gettle is the grandson of Richard Rodgers, a giant of Broadway.
But what he has done is he has incorporated a lot of folk, Appalachian, bluegrass styles and performance practices into the score. What I told the singers when we first started working was, if you listen to early bluegrass music, Ralph Stanley, Bill Monroe, some of those people, and you hear certain ways they sing, you then look at what Gettle has written, and he's actually notated that in the score itself. So I told them, I said, if you just sing what he's written, you're going to capture that Appalachian sound.
Deep in the land of the hollows and creeks, if and you get lost for weeks. Listen to the tale of a man who got lost 100 feet under the winter frost. Now Floyd was a reasoning man. He knew what he wanted and he had a plan. He was just as smart as he was brave. He was gonna find him the perfect cave. Even Floyd knew something wasn't right. He was suffering nightmares at night.
Actor John Kazarowski says there's much to admire about the character of Floyd Collins.
He has this sense of wonder and this awe, and he knows who he is, and he wants to remain true to that no matter what. There are a lot of people who doubt him, including people in his own family, and he always says, he says quite a poignant moment in the thing is that he just feels at home underground. He feels at peace. He feels he's right where he's supposed to be in these caves. He never really diverts from that despite numerous difficulties, trials, failures, even opposition from the people around him. And I really appreciate that that honesty to himself.
Actress Vicki Snyder plays Floyd's sister, Nellie, whom she describes as a very curious person with a close connection to her brother. As the play begins, Nellie has just been released from a mental institution.
Because back then, at least from what I understand, any kind of spiritual awareness or, I would say any kind of spiritual awareness was often misinterpreted as insanity. Yes, that's insanity. So she's an interesting, curious, and spiritual person.
It's interesting you say interesting and curious. I mean, what makes her interesting and curious to you?
What makes her interesting to me is, and I'm still kind of making my choices, just how much does she know? When we say spiritual, you know, is she a God-fearing woman or is she something else? Is she psychic? Is she, you know, does she see visions? I'm kind of discovering that for myself as we keep working on the script here.
Is there a favorite song in the show for you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Through the Mountain. Through the Mountain is kind of like her one big ballad. That's the song that made me want to come out and audition for this show. It has a beautiful melody. It's very pensive, and it's also poignant. I don't want to give away too much of what happens or what she's kind of trying to convey in that song, but it's just a very poignant piece. That's all I'll say.
I know it's a lot to ask, but could you sing a few bars?
Oh, dear. I'ma walk you through the mountain on a bearskin rug to the great halls you dream of and tell of so often. I'm gonna stop. And do come see the show and hear the rest of this beautiful song.
Director Sandra Zelinsky says the cave in which Floyd Collins is trapped is itself a character in the show.
So we have cave lighting, if you will, and then above ground lighting. And we also have lighting that during Carnival, which exists in Floyd's mind, that's something else that is added. So there, it's tiered in a way that you understand this man and what he's going through, where very few people understand that or really know the man.
Zelinsky says the play gives a double-sided view of the media, one exploitative and the other in the form of a sympathetic reporter named Skeets Miller.
You know, the media brought people here to this spot, but there are people who took advantage of that, or outlanders, as they call them, come in, you know, we're going to drill a shaft, not knowing the land, not knowing what happens when it rains, not knowing, or really, I think, caring about the individual. And then you have somebody like Skeets Miller, who was touched by this story, and of course, whose fame came from this story.
And he put a human face on it.
Absolutely. And that is the difference.
Up to the crook where we could look down on the world, Floyd.
Da da dacky dicky da, da da dacky dicky dicka.
Out on a limb where that old.
Vocal director Joe Penrod says, really, the most challenging thing about the score is the score.
Avoiding any hyperbole, this is, I think, the hardest musical I've ever worked on, musically, for everyone concerned. And, you know, I've done a lot of Sondheim. This is, I think, more difficult. There's a lot of meter changes. There's a lot of key changes. The melodies, the vocal lines don't always go where you kind of expect them to as a singer. But like Sondheim, what I've always said about singing his work is it looks difficult on the page until you learn it, and then it makes total sense. And I find that to be true of this score as well. It really looks hard on the page. And it is hard, right? Yeah, they're all nodding their heads. But as we get it into our bones, it does go where you expect it to go.
Although we know from history that Floyd Collins perishes in that cave, director Sandra Zelinsky says he's so appealing that we can't help but root for him, despite knowing his fate.
We hope that he gets out. And even at the end, when he sings that last gorgeous, gorgeous song, you wish it hadn't happened.
Heartland Theater's production of Floyd Collins opens Thursday night and runs through April 22nd at the theater at One Normal Plaza. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The story of Floyd Collins has provided inspiration for many artists, including the band Blackstone Cherry. You're listening to The Ghost of Floyd Collins. It's from their album Folklore and Superstition. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find the Sound Ideas interviews today with help from John Norton, Ryan Denham, Laura Kennedy, and Charlie Schlenker. Also thanks to Loyola superfan John Thomas and Town of Normal Mayor Chris Coos for their time today. Find the full show podcast at WGLT.org or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post your comments at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. Bloomington Normal's public media.